This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jeffrey Mason, has reached the conclusion that all forms of psychotherapy are wrong and often diminish the patient's dignity and freedom. Mason used to be a member of the Freudian Inner Circle. As the project director of the Sigmund Freud Archives, he worked directly with Freud's daughter, Anna. But he challenged Freudian orthodoxy and went public with a letter by Freud that Anna wanted suppressed. It shook up the Freudian establishment. Mason was fired from his position at the Archives in 1981 and was drummed out of the psychoanalytic professional organizations he'd been a member of. Since then, he's written several books condemning Freudian theory and practice. Mason was the subject of a 1981 New Yorker profile by Janet Malcolm, which some readers regarded as revelatory and others saw as character assassination. Mason sued Malcolm for libel, charging that she misrepresented him by fabricating quotes. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear the case. Mason has a new book called Final Analysis about what it was like to undergo training as an orthodox Freudian psychoanalyst. He says psychoanalysis is really a cross between a cult, a club, and a fraternity.
There is a cult-like atmosphere. There's a council of elders. There are ring bearers. There's reverence for the founder. There is, in fact, a founder. And as you might have guessed, I don't like gurus. There are legends passed on, and these legends are not just about Freud, but about other members. There is a conservation, attempt to conserve old values. There's secrecy. There's hazing. There are penalties. In my case, it was I made a Freudian slip there, not dismemberment. It's disbarment, and that's indeed what happened to me. And this is all very much like what goes on in a cult.
Why did you want to go into the field of psychotherapy in the first place?
Well, I believed that there was a great discovery by Freud, namely that sorrow thrives in secrecy and that nothing could be better than opening up this kind of thing. And his original theories about ventilating sorrow, catharsis, seemed to me absolutely correct. And I thought psychoanalysis stands for some kind of deeper truth, that in psychoanalysis, form doesn't count, race doesn't count, sex doesn't count, background doesn't count, religion doesn't count, that it was the great leveler, that it had no ties, it was totally independent, it was the exercise of pure intelligence. And I discovered that that was not true.
When you were a student of Freudian analysis, you had to undergo analysis yourself. Did you see that student analysis as an initiation rite?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what you learn there is really not to say the things that you honestly believe, because you can get yourself into great trouble. In fact, the very notion of telling somebody in the room what you really think about that person and expecting them to listen to that objectively without getting enraged at you is absurd. It doesn't happen in real life, and it doesn't happen in psychoanalysis. The only advantage, since you have absolutely no power in that situation, and the analyst has all the power, the advantage for him is that he doesn't have to say how he feels. He can just turn red in silence. You can't even see him. And he may think to himself, I'll get that little SOB sooner or later.
When you were being screened by a therapist to see whether or not you would be good material to enter the school of psychoanalysis, one of the questions you were asked was, are you monogamous? And you thought that that was really an impossible question to deal with honestly in a situation that wasn't about your therapy, but was rather about your potential as a student and analyst. Is that typical of what you felt you were up against?
Well, yeah, I think that is typical. There are all kinds of unwritten rules, again, like in a sect. For example, you cannot be... Psychoanalysis really is a hymn of praise to mediocrity, so they don't allow people with revolutionary ideas into it. They are also homophobic, as you probably know, and they would not allow... If you were to say that you were homosexual, you would not be allowed to be trained in the American psychoanalytic institutes today. So that you have to be constantly on the qui vive not to say something that is going to anger them or make them decide that you don't have the potential for being an analyst. And it's not apparent to you at the time you're doing that. This is a corrupting experience.
What is the ultimate goal in Freudian analysis?
Well, it's difficult to say. There's an apocryphal statement that Freud said it's to be able to work and to love. There's no direct statement to that effect. The only thing that Freud actually said was in 1895, and I used to think it was a marvelous phrase. I'm a little bit skeptical now, but he said the goal of analysis is to transform neurotic misery into common, ordinary human unhappiness. But it seems to me that to pay $150 every day, 5 days a week for the next 10 years to learn that, I think you can just read Freud and save yourself a great deal of money.
There were lots of things that disturbed you about your analyst when you were going through psychoanalysis. I'd like to discuss a little bit of that. Can you tell the story of what he said about your wife, who you were discussing as being very intelligent but not conventionally beautiful, and you said that you were sometimes bothered by the fact that she wasn't beautiful and you found yourself being attracted to beautiful women?
Right. Well, I think, you know, this touched a sore spot for him in many ways, as one indeed always does with an analyst. There's something they're not going to be able to resonate to. And my, what they call the presenting symptom, it's a hateful term, was promiscuity. That is, I came in and I said, Dr. Schiffer, I've slept with more women than I should have, and I've never fallen in love, or very rarely. There's something wrong with me. And eventually he made the interpretation that the reason was I was not married to a beautiful woman. The reason I was finding monogamy so difficult is my wife wasn't beautiful. And he made some really horrendously sexist and speciesist comment about my wife. And I said, but this is your opinion. He said, no, it's your opinion. It's in your unconscious, and you just can't own up to it. You can't face this reality. And he said, look, I ought to know. I married. You married. He was constantly interpreting what was wrong with my wife as well. And he said, you see, the reason she's so intelligent, she was remarkably intelligent woman. She's now a lawyer. And he said, is because she's displaced her envy of the penis into the brain. So instead of having a brain, she has a penis, a large penis in her head. That's why she's so smart. And it's because she's not beautiful. I ought to know. I did what any normal man should do. I married a beautiful but dumb woman. And your problem is you didn't do that. Now, this was outrageous at the time he said it. But he was constantly making interpretations of this kind. And when you're in that sort of powerless situation where you think this marvelous human being has some special insight into my soul, you think, well, maybe it's something that I have refused to face. Maybe I have denied this. I must look into myself instead of saying, you have no business saying things like that to anybody, let alone to a patient.
Yeah, but what I don't understand is that you really didn't think he was such a marvelous person. You thought that he was self-centered and that his insights were often totally off track, that he was manipulative, authoritarian. So why'd you stick it out?
Well, because when you're in that kind of one-down situation and you're unhappy and your life seems to be falling apart, you're not at your best to discern what's wrong with somebody. It's true that eventually I began to see a pattern with Schiffer. I began to see that I wasn't simply projecting these qualities from me onto him, that he really was a human being in his own right with all his many and obvious failings. But it took me a long time to see that. Now, remember also that I was in training, and he made it very clear from the first time I raised an objection to the language he was using against me. He said, look, if you go outside of this session and start telling people what I say here, I'm going to deny it, and you will not get any training. You'll be thrown out of the program. And I said, but that's blackmail. And he said, yes, but I'm doing it for your good. It's because nobody else in this city is able to treat you except me, so I'm going to keep you whatever it costs. And I was partly flattered, partly appalled, but I believed him for a short while. I thought he has some special insight into me. After all, he's, quote, a trained analyst. He's in his 60s. He's been doing this for 40 years. He must know something about me that I don't know. I was very wrong.
Jeffrey Mason is my guest, and he's the author of the new book, Final Analysis, The Making and Unmaking of a Psychoanalyst. You were briefly an analyst yourself. How did you like it?
I didn't like it. I found that I really did not have a talent. Let me make it clear, by the way, that I think there are some wonderful therapists and some wonderful analysts out there. I know I live with a therapist, but they are rare, and I believe that they're born, not trained, and it's very difficult to find one. The idea of an institute, for example, an institute for human kindness, is a kind of oxymoron. You can't train people to be kind or benevolent or compassionate. This is something, I don't know if people are born with it or learn it in their human relationships, but it's certainly not something you're taught in an institute, nor could you be.
Do you say you live with a therapist now?
I do, yes.
Well, what's their reaction to statements like yours that, you know, that all therapy is useless?
Well, she had some of these opinions before I started to live with her. And there are areas, of course, of disagreement. Remember that my argument is not with therapists, it's with therapy. And I believe that she, for example, is a warm and kind human being. Her name is Dady Donnelly. Not because of any training she had, but rather in spite of whatever training she had.
The most controversial action that you took while you were in the Freudian establishment had to do with Freud's seduction theory and a document that you found about it. So before we get into the letter that you discovered, describe what the seduction theory was and why Freud had abandoned it.
Well, this was Freud's early belief, and by early I mean 1896, that patients, many of the women who came to see him, in fact most of them, he said, had been sexually abused in early childhood. And he believed the women. And he thought, and I think he was right to think so, that he had made a revolutionary discovery and that he was, in fact, the first male to say this openly. And he gave a very brave paper on this called The Etiology of Hysteria in 1896 before his psychiatric colleagues. The response was ice. They simply froze him out. He was horrified by this. He expected to be received with great applause for them to say, what a courageous man you are to admit that these things go on, instead of which they walked out in silence. He wrote to his best friend the next day, a void is forming around me. The word has been given out to abandon me. Now, shortly thereafter, in fact, a year later, he did himself abandon the seduction hypothesis. He said he had been wrong. These male psychiatrists, but there were no women in the room, by the way, were right all along that there was no sexual abuse. It was all in the minds of his patients. That's called the abandonment of the seduction hypothesis. And Freud dates the beginning of psychoanalysis from that momentous decision that he had made a mistake. And our first knowledge of that mistake came in a letter that Freud wrote on September 21st, 1897, to his best friend Wilhelm Fliess. And that letter was published by Anna Freud. What she omitted, however, was a letter a few months later in which Freud said, I think I may have made a mistake. I'm beginning to believe that it is real and that it happens more frequently than I knew. And he gives there what is, in fact, his most elaborate clinical case history from the early days of a woman who was raped by her father when she was 2 years old, anally raped, nearly bled to death as a result of this. And at the end of this story, Freud has this tremendous outcry from his heart where he says, Wilhelm, I think we need a new motto for psychoanalysis. It should be, poor child, what have they done to you? Now that letter, and Anna Freud, I remember my shock when I noticed that Anna Freud had taken a red pencil and simply crossed it out and put not for publication. And I went to her with this letter that I now had the original of in my hand, and I said, Miss Freud, how could you omit something like this? This is one of Freud's great moments. In fact, it's one of the great moments in Western history. How could you omit it? And she said, well, he was wrong, as he later recognized, and it would simply confuse people to leave in a record like something like that in the record. And I showed my amazement at this reasoning, and she said, you see there, you are a member of the public and you are confused, so I was right to omit it. And I think that analysts were very upset when this record was put straight and we were able to see in context, and I published these letters eventually with Harvard University Press, to see the development of Freud's thought and to realize that there's more of a story around his abandonment of the sexual seduction hypothesis than we had been led to believe by the chroniclers of psychoanalysis. Something was not entirely right with this history.
Freud had many patients who claimed to have been sexually abused by adults. And after a while, he started thinking that they made it up.
That's right.
That it was fantasy.
That's right.
So he abandoned the theory that child abuse led to neurosis or hysteria.
That's correct.
Because he thought that these children weren't really abused. They were just imagining they were
That's
abused.
Right.
When you uncovered a letter about how he was having second thoughts about abandoning this theory, what reaction did you get from other analysts?
You see, the reaction was, this should be en famille. It's okay to talk about this between you and Anna Freud and Kurt Eisler and a few of the other analysts of the inner circle, but you mustn't allow the public to know about this because it's going to encourage a certain skepticism about psychoanalysis. And my feeling was, then that skepticism is well justified. This must be known. There are any number of women who've come to analysts and psychiatrists in the years since Freud to talk about real abuse, only to be told it's only a fantasy. That always seemed to me wrong, but now here was direct evidence that Freud himself had doubts about this. I thought it should be put back in the record, and I couldn't understand why analysts were so terrified of this kind of information. Now, I did speculate as to why Freud might have done it, and I must say here that it is pure speculation. We simply don't know. I know that I would regard it as a failure of moral courage. I think he felt he couldn't possibly survive in Viennese medical society. People would not send him referrals. He would not, if he stood by the women, it would show enormous courage, but it wouldn't help him make a living. And I think that possibly unconsciously, I don't think he ever made the conscious decision, but I think he was under so much pressure that he finally caved in and decided to go along with what everybody else thought. And I think that was the beginning of the downfall of psychoanalysis. It's turning away from the real world.
Can you explain why there would have been pressure on Freud to disbelieve the women who told him that they were abused as children?
Well, for many reasons. Think of it. At that point, women in Viennese society had absolutely no power. Secondly, he was saying this. Just think of where he announced it to the Viennese Psychiatric Society. Now, he was talking to only men in that room. There was no woman in there who could get up and say, you know, you're a right-on man, Sigmund, you're right. It happened to me and it happened to my sister. There was nobody to say that. There were no female researchers like Diana Russell today doing this extraordinarily important work that shows us how real sexual abuse is. So Freud had nobody in his audience but people who were either deeply skeptical for reasons of their own or who were themselves perpetrators, men who actually were abusing their children or other young children. Obviously, these were not the very people who were going to cheer Freud on in his search for some deeper truth.
You were reasonably comfortable, I think, being a member of the Freudian establishment. You were the head of the Freud archives until you were drummed out after the controversy over Freud's seduction theory. And I can't help but wondering how much of what you're telling us today is based on a vendetta against the Freudian establishment because of the way they reacted to you. And I say that because it wasn't until you were drummed out of the establishment that that you challenged everything, at least in a public way, the way you're doing now. And you're challenging, like, everything from top to bottom.
Sure.
And you've condemned the whole field of therapy altogether, Freudian and other kinds of therapy.
That's a good point. But let me remind you that I had actually published a number of articles which contained many of the same ideas I'm now saying, but that were published in standard analytic journals, and therefore the International Journal of Psychoanalysis. I wrote 3 articles to this effect. But since so few people read that, people didn't care. Analysts said, oh, well, so what? So Mason has these rather eccentric, revolutionary ideas about the reality of child abuse. What do we care? It's when, A, I found documents that showed that I wasn't simply barking in the night, that there was something real happening there, and that it was supported by actual letters by Freud himself and other material out of the archives in Europe, that they began to worry. And when the New York Times started writing about it, and they felt that he's reaching a wider public. Now, let me also remind you that in my last book, Against Therapy, where I talk about emotional tyranny and the myth of psychological healing, the subtitle, it was not only psychoanalysis that upset me. And remember, once I was no longer a psychoanalyst, I had still been trained, so I was perfectly entitled to practice psychotherapy and could easily have done so and made a very comfortable living. In fact, made 10 times what I make now as a writer. And the reason I decided against that was not because I couldn't do it or because of rancor at psychoanalysts, but because I believed it was wrong. And that's what I tried to explain in that rather unpopular book called Against Therapy. So I don't think it's true to say that I only did this as a vendetta. I did it because I really believed it was true. And I did it reluctantly and sadly. It was a comfortable living. To some extent, I like clubs, too. I don't belong to any and never would. But the idea of being with a group of people and being able to have friends that believe similar things that you do is something that attracts me. It still does. I'm just sorry I can't be a member of anything.
There are some schools of therapy that disagree with Freud just about as strongly as you do. And I think a lot of the feminist therapists surely reject the theory of penis envy as much as you do. Are you as distrustful of, say, feminist therapy and the schools of therapy that have turned against Freudian analysis as you are Freudian analysis itself?
Well, you know, I would have said, if you'd asked me a few years ago, I would have said no. I would have said the feminists and the radical therapists are all moving in the right direction. Now I'm a little bit more skeptical. I must say that I am really deeply skeptical of anybody who claims to be an expert in your internal life. I simply believe they don't exist. It worries me that some feminists who have not been abused want to treat women who have been. I think it's very difficult to do that. Unless you've been there yourself, you can't really know what it's like. This is why I think self-help groups without professionals and without money passing hands is much better. And the great names in therapy do not fare very well in the light of objective knowledge. None of them. Freud, Jung, Binswanger, Perls, Carl Rogers, Milton Erickson, John Rosen, Bruno Bettelheim. Now, we notice that most of those are men, it's true. And I was hoping initially that women would change this. But I think the extent to which women buy into this larger system, and here I'm thinking of the work of Catherine MacKinnon and Andrea Dworkin, who've made me aware of this kind of disaster that happens when women buy into, they use the term patriarchy, but I think there's some truth to that. They are then forced to adopt a lot of the ideas that their instincts would tell them are not right. And I'm worried that feminist therapists, I would almost say that that's a contradiction in terms. You can't be both a feminist and a therapist. There's something about therapy that is anti-feminist.
You mean because it's authoritarian?
It's not. It is authoritarian. It also tends to blame the victim. It tends to look inside when it should be looking outside. It says things like, what have you done to bring this on? Otherwise, it's not really therapy. As so many women have pointed out, you know, when a therapist says, well, what were you doing to make your husband hit you? And the woman says, I wasn't doing anything. I was just standing within reach of his arm. And of course, they then can't. The therapist must think to himself or herself, well, what can I do about that? I can't get rid of her husband. I can't give her shelter. I can't give her food or money to help her. So all I can do is interpret. And that's really not what those women need.
I have to tell you that I know a lot of people who've been in and out of therapy over the years, and some of them felt it didn't help much, but others felt that it helped them quite a bit. And I can't believe that you've never met anybody who feels that they were helped by therapy. And if you have met people who feel that they were really helped by therapy, how can you believe that therapy is totally and completely useless?
Well, there's no doubt that people have been helped and have told me that. And I would say about half the people I meet tell me it was wonderful and the other half say it was terrible. But what I'm concerned with is that when you go into therapy, you are giving your consent and that your consent be informed. And to be genuinely informed, we have to know a great deal more than we now know about the other side of therapy. After all, if you walk into any good bookstore in America and go to the section on psychology or psychiatry, there are literally hundreds of books that will tell you how wonderful it is. There are very few books that will warn you of the dangers. And that's what frightens me. That my great objection is that psychiatry seems to have a fear of taking, and psychoanalysis too, even psychology, a fear of taking an unsentimental and unflinching look at their own past.
Jeffrey Mason, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Mason, his new book is Final Analysis, The Making and Unmaking of a Psychoanalyst.